Withers has been called one of the most experienced private investigators, a man whose career has ranged from tracking IRA operatives to advising governments to helping foil a coup in Equatorial Guinea. He has interviewed high-profile prisoners, operated across continents, and worked in cases that blend espionage, politics, and justice. Among his most high-profile stakes assignments was the years-long hunt for Oliver O'Grady, one of the Catholic Church's most notorious paedophile priests. Acting on behalf of victims and legal teams, Withers tracked O'Grady across the Netherlands, Portugal and Ireland, often while the former priest was living under the radar. Today he joins us to take us inside that manhunt and to reflect on a lifetime spent in the world's shadows. Ian, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You've had quite an extraordinary career, from tracking IRA suspects like John Downey to advising the Seychelles government to helping stop the Wanga coup in Equatorial Guinea. Which case first shaped you as an investigator?
Well, that would be very difficult to say. To be honest, I started in the 1960s, before the advent of internet, even before the advent of mobile phones. Frankly, the shaping of your career directly resulted from the basic bread and butter investigative techniques that you picked up during those days without all those facilities. Those were the days when you went out to conduct inquiries, for example, to trace someone. You ended up knocking on doors down many, many streets till you eventually found someone that could give you a lead that you then had to follow up. You had to go to the library or to the local island, to the Garda station, to look at electoral registers, to see the names of the neighbours, and then check in the phone book if any of them were on the telephone so you could phone. Pretext became second nature. There was no point in phoning up somebody and saying you're hunting them down because they owe money. So you'd come up with a scam, such as they were an old school friend or you had a delivery for them. Anything to get the result that you wanted to achieve for your client.
And we touched on some of the, I suppose, high-profile cases that you've worked on. Did those earlier political and, I suppose, intelligence-heavy cases prepare you in any way for pursuing someone like Oliver O'Grady?
Well, each and every assignment you learn from, you gather your experience from the problems you may have and how you overcome those problems. So it would be correct to say that every job that we have undertaken, be it small or large, has prepared you for the next job that's coming along. And that certainly was the case with O'Grady.
Okay, and let's focus on that then. What was the moment you realised O'Grady was not just hiding, but actively evading justice across countries?
Well, I think we realised that was likely to be the case from the moment we were instructed by the US law firm that were mounting a class action against O'Grady and the Catholic Church Diocese in Stockport in California. And they needed to find him to serve him with the legal documentation. Despite the evil that he had perpetrated, he still had the right in law to be advised as to what the accusations were and to have the opportunity to defend or negotiate a plea agreement of some kind in the legal proceedings. So once he was in Ireland, we knew that we had a problem because he wasn't actually available. It was only a tip-off that we found out that he was in a Catholic retreat near Limerick, and only real luck rather than anything else that we actually managed, or my agent actually managed to find him whilst he was conducting a surveillance around there and got talking to him. And that was our lead in. And then, of course, as we know, the lawyers, being economically concerned, decided not to have surveillance conducted until the legal papers were ready and delivered to us. They asked us to cease the surveillance, and by the time we'd gone back with the papers, he had gone. And that started a whole new chase. And it took quite a long time and really a lot of phone calls, a lot of correspondence, and a lot of help from the church itself and the local Gardaí, we eventually got the lead that he was in Rotterdam.
Working with children?
Yeah, unbelievably. He was working at a child's school and literally looking after their religious interests. It's almost beyond belief that these things could happen, but there he was. Once he was aware that we'd caught up with him, then of course he skipped again and went back to Ireland, because strangely enough, at that point, he wasn't wanted in Ireland. It was his home country. He hadn't known or been known to have committed any offences in Ireland. So he did a runner for the airport and came straight back on an Aer Lingus flight to Dublin. And in his rush to get off the flight, he left his little laptop computer on board by mistake. And as it was, the guards actually picked him up on arrival and they interviewed him, but they had nothing to hold him on. So he was released. And it was only later that they picked up the laptop and found that he had once again been downloading images right up to the previous couple of days, for which he was subsequently charged and then imprisoned in Ireland for that offence. Meanwhile, one of the guards very kindly let us know where he was staying, and we attended and met with him, and the process server that met with him found a very subdued, frightened man in many ways, and he accepted the process without any difficulty or hesitation.
Was there ever a time during the period that you tried to track him down that you feared he would vanish permanently?
Well, there was always the possibility. With anyone in his position, he was fundamentally on the run. And he also had, to a large extent, the protection of the Catholic Church. Not that they were trying to hide him in the sense of avoiding justice, that they felt they had an obligation to one of their own to at least assist him, possibly in the forlorn hope that he might ask for forgiveness and maybe restart his life and standards. Yes, there was times where we thought it may be a mission impossible, but as with all of these things, you have to keep going.
And just looking at your investigative methods and challenges in both political and criminal cases, how do you balance persistence with staying inside legal boundaries? You describe yourself as controversial.
Well, in fact, it wasn't me that described myself as controversial. It was the media. Thank you very much. Okay. I've had to live with it ever since. Fundamentally, it all boils down to ethics, and ethics has become quite difficult and more complex as time has gone on. One of the reasons is the invention of data protection, the advent and creation of data protection, the right of property in data has changed a lot of things. So whereas it was considered almost normal to tell a white lie to obtain information, provided the purpose you were obtaining it was lawful and reasonable and justifiable, then you would tell a white lie to trace a debtor, for example. Well, the example we always use is the criminal workman that knocks on the widow's house and says there's a loose tile on the roof, makes her pay him a lump of money up front, and then disappears and doesn't come back. And the only information that she's got is maybe his vehicle number or his phone number. Can you get the guards or the police in England to do anything about it? Frankly, you can't. They'll give you a crime number so you can claim on insurance. And that is the sorry situation that we live in. So when people like us are tasked on behalf of victims of that nature, we may stretch the boundaries a bit in order to get information. Now, is it ethical? The ethics, we feel, are owed to the client, whereas ethics as a whole are based on society in general. And it's a very difficult balance.
So what would you say then during your time as a private investigator, what would have been the most effective tools you had?
Oh, well, there's no doubt at all. In recent times, we've had the advent of AI, and prior to that, the internet generally, the information facilities, the electronic age has been fantastic. And what most people don't necessarily realise is that whenever they sign up for anything, they tend, without realising it, to tick a box which enables their information to be produced and sold online with data consolidators. Mm. And they end up in databases that we can subscribe to and get information which people would wonder how we got it, but it's because it was consented to in at an earlier time.
And just, I was interested as well just about your work regarding the Wonga coup, and you uncovered evidence linking Sir Mark Thatcher to the plot. For people who aren't aware of what that coup was, can you give us a little bit of a background and give us an oversight into how you handled situations where findings carry potentially huge political fallout?
Well, we fell into that one, to be honest about it. We were introduced to it through the Sunday Times, an English newspaper, also published in the Republic, who were following up a story. We got engaged in the story. Ultimately, the lawyers that were representing the Equatorial Guinea government then employed us to conduct work in South Africa. The instructions that we had were to try to determine whether Mark Thatcher, the son of the ex-British Prime Minister, was directly involved in the funding of a planned coup to overthrow the Equatorial Guinea government and enable the previous president to come back together with the coup plotters and to capitalize on having control of the oil reserves of Equatorial Guinea. Fundamentally, that's what the objective of the coup was. And so our job was to do some work in South Africa, which we did through local agents. Many of these cases we manage rather than are physically out knocking on doors. Mm. So we used South African agents, and they were able to obtain eventually the phone bills that Mark Thatcher's home, which indicated he had a large number of phone lines. And the call history of those phone lines enabled evidence to be established that he had been in direct communication with Simon Mann, who was the operational leader, and with the financier in London, Eli Khalil, and to prove that he was involved in the planning and the operations well before the actual event occurred. And it was that evidence which ultimately, when it was presented to his own lawyers in South Africa, persuaded him that he would be better to plead guilty to the offences of which he was charged rather than denying them, which was his original plan.
Quite a bombshell to make that discovery in terms of the phone calls.
It was incredibly lucky. And South Africa, unlike Europe or certainly the UK and Ireland, seemed to have much easier access to information which we would regard as so confidential that it wouldn't be available in the public domain or even permitted to be used in legal proceedings.
And look, Ian, we can't cover this interview without mentioning the fact that you were arrested in 2018 in connection with a decades-old Seychelles murder case. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what went through your mind and how you view that experience now? Why were you arrested in that case?
Well, I was arrested allegedly with an accusation of conspiracy to murder in 2018. This related to the murder of a dissident leader of the anti-Seychelles government movement in London, which occurred in November of 1985. So you can see it was many years after the event that I was arrested. I'm really still not quite sure why I was arrested. I was one of a number of people. I believe I'm the only one left alive. All of the others had passed away at one time or another. And one of the reasons, of course, was that from 1979 up till 1986, I had been working for the Seychelles government in the capacity of a national security advisor, which actually meant I conducted the external surveillance of the organization and people that were mounting attempted coups against the Seychelles government.
Ian, just to wrap up, has there ever been a moment, I mean, it's quite an extraordinary career that you have, and it is detailed in your book, Private Eye Secrets by My Life as Britain's Most Controversial PI, but was there ever a moment when you felt mentally or physically challenged and you thought, you know, the ethical lines here are becoming too blurred, I need to take a step back? Did you ever feel like that?
Well, I suppose I probably did. It's kind of difficult to explain, but each and every assignment that came in, it becomes a personal challenge to try and achieve a result, even if the result is not what the client expected. But I think the most difficult time I ever had was having been arrested or apprehended in Argentina during the junta time, when we were trying to recover two children that had been snatched by one of their parents and been missing for over 10 years from the United States. We located them in Argentina and set up an arrangement to meet with the father to try and negotiate their return. He tipped off the police that we were going to kidnap them, and myself and a colleague were arrested and kept in an Argentine jail cell which was no fun, for a period of 7 days where we honestly thought we were going to be executed by the junta. It was a military-type operation, and it was pure luck that we managed to wangle our way out of it through a local police officer whose wife had been an au pair in Brighton in England, where our office was at that time.
Wow.
And her father happened to be the local judge, and we had to agree to plead guilty to an offence that we didn't even know what it was. And he gave us 7 days to leave Argentina. We later found out that the charge that we pleaded guilty to was entering Argentina as a tourist whilst we were working.
Probably a lot lesser charge than you expected at the time.
I think we were very lucky to get out of there, and it's explained in the book, as you say, the whole story. And there's also a book by the mother that we acted for, which is a heart-rending story of how she had to hunt for her two missing children for so long.
Is it a viable career still? Do you have any advice for maybe the next generation of investigators?
Yes, it's very much a viable career. It's a career that is likely to grow in demand. The system is very different now, and anyone planning to come into the investigative field needs to look at starting off their life with some legal knowledge and a university attendance on criminology and related law would be a really good start, and even to go through a lawyer's office for a time to decide if inquiries are really what they want to do, and then to pick which element. Now we have such a wide variety of potential specialities.
Well, look, that was Ian Withers, and anyone interested in learning more about these stories can pick up a copy of Ian's book. Ian, what's the best place for people to find the book, to get their hands on the book?
Well, Private Eye Secret Spy is available on Amazon and can be downloaded as an audio book or as Kindle. And the English version, which is Dangerous Escapades, is available on Amazon.
Brilliant. Ian, thanks so much for your time.